Kay headed the Iraq Survey Group, a 1,400-plus person fact-finding mission set up by the Pentagon and the CIA to search for WMD in Iraq. Based on what we were being told, we sensed that while large stockpiles were unlikely to be discovered, some small stocks of chemical or biological weapons still might be found, along with evidence of WMD research and development programs. If that happened, it would greatly weaken Democratic attacks asserting that the Bush administration had exaggerated the threat or deliberately misled the American people to sell war. NBC News anchor Tom Brokaw interviewed Kay in mid-July about the effort. He introduced the interview by saying, Kay, a cautious professional who is well aware of the political pressure, is confident he can make the case against Saddam Hussein on WMD. Kay then told Brokaw that within 6 months, he expected to find a substantial body of evidence to demonstrate that Saddam had a WMD program. Kay's optimism provided some comfort to us in the White House, false comfort as it turned out. But at the time, his ongoing efforts allowed us in the administration to fend off questions about the intelligence used to justify war. Lacking evidence to support what we'd confidently convinced ourselves to believe, we could still defer or evade getting drawn into acknowledging any definitive judgments about the rationale while the Iraq Survey Group continued its work. In early October, Kay released an interim progress report. He cautioned that it was still too early to reach final conclusions. The study group had discovered dozens of WMD program-related activities, but no weapons of mass destruction. We quickly pounced on the report as proof that Saddam Hussein had been a material breach of Resolution 1441, which had given him one final opportunity to comply with UN disarmament demands or face serious consequences. The report showed that the president had been right to eliminate the danger his regime posed to the world, as Colin Powell stated. Our talking point had now shifted from focusing on WMD to WMD programs, though if asked, we would say we continued to believe weapons would eventually be found. War critics and some Democrats used the Kay report to again raise the possibility that the administration had at a minimum hyped the WMD threat from Iraq. It was a theme that Diane Sawyer pressed Bush to address during an interview at the White House a couple of months later in December 2003. Citing a poll showing that 50% of Americans believed the administration had exaggerated the evidence in the buildup to war, Sawyer asked if the president felt that they were wrong or misguided. Bush declined to take the bait. He said the intelligence had been sound and that there was no doubt that Saddam Hussein was a threat. Sawyer sought to pin him down, saying that before the war, he and others had asserted there was no doubt that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. The president returned to his oft-repeated assertion that he'd made the right decision regardless of the presence or absence of WMD. Saddam Hussein was a danger and the world is better off because we got rid of him, he said. Sawyer pressed again, focusing on the distinction between WMD and WMD programs. The administration, she pointed out, had previously asserted that there were weapons of mass destruction as opposed to the possibility that he could move to acquire those weapons still. Bush's response was telling, much more so than I stopped to contemplate at the time. So what's the difference? Bush asked. After all, if Saddam had acquired WMD, he would still have been a danger. Bush declined to say whether the administration could have been more precise in laying out the evidence prior to the war and dismissed criticism that it might have been misleading. He asserted again that everyone had seen the same intelligence and come to the same conclusion. Saddam Hussein was a threat that needed to be dealt with. The president's response received quite a bit of media attention and criticism from Democrats, some of whom noted that the rationale had been that the Iraqi regime posed an urgent threat that required preemptive action. But at the time, it did not have an immediate negative impact on public opinion. Just before Sawyer's interview, our troops had captured Saddam Hussein, pulling him out of the spider hole in which he'd hidden. The good news gave us a temporary bump in support for the war. Still, the narrative of exaggeration or deliberate deception had been established at least as far back as the 16 words controversy. Our lack of candor and slowness in doing something to address the problem, even by investigating why it was wrong, only allowed it to take hold. The president was right. that virtually everyone had the same intelligence to review and believed Saddam Hussein was a danger. But he was the one who rapidly pushed the country toward war, based on the way his advisors packaged the intelligence to sound more certain, grave, and urgent than it was turning out to be. Because of our continuing lack of openness and forthrightness about the case for war, the president was boxing himself in, deepening suspicion and fueling partisan combat. It allowed some critics and partisan Democrats to raise questions and insinuate deliberate deception about how Bush's team of policymakers had used intelligence to sell the war. But since we avoided discussing it or fully examining the truth of how the case was made, we could only counterattack by questioning, though not completely dispelling, the honesty or fairness of their arguments. So the verbal warfare would only accelerate. The media in such an instance might fairly be accused of overemphasizing the controversy and allowing deceitful attacks against us to receive too much attention. But our spin and evasion were leaving lingering questions unaddressed and opening the administration to growing criticism. It was a narrative that could only be changed through candor and a willingness to accept some short-term political pain by acknowledging our own mistakes. In hindsight, we missed our opportunity to put that narrative to rest for good. To do so, the president would have had to fully investigate the selling of the war, openly accept responsibility, and then hold top people accountable. Instead, the president was on a course that would ultimately lead to a much heavier price being paid in terms of his credibility and legacy. That course led in January 2004 to another major setback in the struggle for public support. David Kaye resigned as head of the Iraq Survey Group that month and testified before Congress that there were no WMD stockpiles to be found. "It turns out we were all wrong, probably in my judgment," Kaye stated. Along with prominent Democrats, Kaye called for an independent outside inquiry into the apparent failure of U.S. intelligence. But Kaye stated he did not believe the administration had pressured intelligence analysts to exaggerate the threat. In the summer of 2004, the Senate Intelligence Committee would reach similar conclusions, stating that policymakers had been misled by faulty intelligence and putting off any examination of how the intelligence was used by policymakers. Bush and his advisors feared outside investigations. However, as momentum built for yet another independent probe, we saw the benefit of acting quickly and on our terms. Bush soon announced the creation of a bipartisan independent commission to look into our intelligence on WMD, including Iraq. Its members were appointed by the president and its scope set by his team. It would not include looking at how the intelligence had been used to make the case for war. That was something Bush and his top advisors sought to avoid, concerned at a minimum, particularly in an election year, that it would prove politically fatal. They were willing to allow things to become more politicized, some considering it a battle that could be fought to a draw or even used to motivate the base, and believed that the short-term political cost could be minimized. In Bush's mind, how the case for war had been made scarcely mattered. What mattered now was the policy and showing success. The public tends to be more forgiving when the results are promising. If the policy was right and the selling of the policy could be justified at the time, then any difference between the two mattered little. In this view, governing successfully in Washington is about winning public opinion and getting positive results. To this day, the president seems unbothered by the disconnect between the chief rationale for war and the driving motivation behind it, and unconcerned about how the case was packaged. The policy is the right one, and history will judge it so, once a free Iraq is firmly in place and the Middle East begins to become more democratic. Bush clung to the same belief during an interview with Tim Russert of NBC News in early February 2004. The Meet the Press host asked, "In light of not finding the weapons of mass destruction, do you believe the war in Iraq is a war of choice or a war of necessity?" The president said, "That's an interesting question. Please elaborate on that a little bit. A war of choice or a war of necessity?" "It's a war of necessity. In my judgment, we had no choice when we look at the intelligence I looked at that says the man was a threat." I remember talking to the president about this question following the interview. He seemed puzzled and asked me what Russert was getting at with the question. This, in turn, puzzled me. Surely this distinction between a necessary, unavoidable war and a war that the United States could have avoided but chose to wage was an obvious one that Bush must have thought about in the months before the invasion. Evidently, it wasn't obvious to the president, nor did his national security team make sure it was. He set the policy early on, and then his team focused his attention on how to sell it. It strikes me today as an indication of his lack of inquisitiveness and his detrimental resistance to reflection, something his advisors needed to compensate for better than they did.